Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
It is a pleasure to introduce Craig Johnson tonight, and I know you are all here and interested and excited to hear what he has to say. He first had his introduction to Wyoming when he was out east and drove a truckload of horses to Wyoming and thought, oh, maybe this isn't too bad a place to live. Well, he returned, bought some land, built a house, and started writing. And he has been in Wyoming since. I'm sure you're aware that he has won a number of awards for his books that he has written. How many have read any of his Longmire series? Have any of you seen the TV show Longmire? Yeah, okay. So we are pleased to have Craig Johnson tonight coming down from a little tiny town in Wyoming that has a population of 25. But he is here to introduce to you his new book, Wait for Signs. Please join me in welcoming Craig Johnson.
Thank you, dear. Good to be here. This is a whole new venue for me. I haven't been to this particular Tattered Cover. Like I've done all of the others before, and I thought they were just kicking me out of each one of them as they went. I figured it was what they were doing. But it's really wonderful to be back. It's really wonderful to be back in my own time zone. I got to say, like that. But a lot of strange things happening. I don't know. You know, there's a story that I tell, and I think I told this last year when I was at the Tattered Cover up in Colfax. Like, but it kind of indicates what my life has been like here in the last 3 years. And so I'm going to tell it again. Like it. So I hope you'll bear with me. I'll try not to keep it too long like that. But we start our tours up at the Buffalo Bill Museum up in Cody. And if you haven't been to the Buffalo Bill Museum, make sure you get up there and get a chance to go because it's a really fantastic museum. And so we were up there and we start off on the tour and we head up to Billings because my wife won't fly on the planes that go in and out of where we live in Wyoming because they're the ones that give you the leather helmet and goggles and say, you know, jump on the plane when it starts rolling like that. And so anyway, we're on our way up to Billings to catch a plane like that, but I'm getting hungry. And so Judy knows that traveling with me is kind of like traveling with a trained bear, you know. As long as the bear stays fed, we're all going to be okay. Like that. And so, you know, I was getting hungry and she said, we better stop in Red Lodge and get something to eat. So we stop in a little cafe and we're getting something to eat and I'm writing a check for lunch. And when I'm not wearing one of these, like I'm wearing one of those Absaroka County Sheriff's Department ball caps that I've seen a couple of out here in the audience. Like, and hold those up, guys, if you would. Like, and let them see. There they are. See, they work for the department, so they have to sit in the back. And so, anyway, like if you didn't know, you know, that there was no 24th County in Wyoming, if you didn't know there was no such thing as Absaroka County, they look pretty real, right? So I've got one of those things on, like, and I'm writing the check for lunch, and the woman behind the counter, she goes, "Where'd you get that hat?" And I thought, oh, no, she thinks I'm a real sheriff's deputy, and I'm going to have to go chase, you know, somebody down the main street of Red Lodge, you know. And so I look at her, and I pointed at my head, and I said, "It's not a real county." And she goes, "The hell it's not. It's Walt Longmire's county." So I said, "Well, I'm Craig Johnson." And she goes, "So?" And I said, "Well, I'm the guy that writes the books." She goes, "What books?" It was about then that little voice in the back of my head started going, "You know, you should just leave now." But my pride wouldn't let me do it. And I said, "The books that the TV show is based off of." And she looked at me. I'll never forget her response. She goes, "There are books?" And so I told Viking Penguin that was going to be our motto from here on out. Yes, there are books, you know. So on in front of every Walt Longmire novel like that. And some exciting news like that actually that happened just today. This little guy just landed at number 14 on the New York Times bestsellers list. So, hey. You guys did the heavy lifting on this one. Look at me. Not bad for a collection of short stories, for gosh sakes. And I don't know if you guys know how the whole short story thing started up. I mean, what happened was is that whenever I first started writing, look at my wife, we were sitting there at the ranch, and so she had a copy of Cowboys and Indians magazine sitting in front of her. Look at, and she looks at me, and she turns it around and slides it underneath my coffee cup. And what it was it was the Cowboys and Indians Tony Hillerman Award short story contest like that. And so it had to be a short story, and it had to have it had to be a mystery, and it had to have a cowboy and or Indians in it. And so, you know, she slides this thing under my coffee cup and says, "You should do that." And I said, undaunted by the fact that I'd never written a short story, I said, "You know, well, I don't write short stories, so, you know, I wouldn't be able to, you know, compete in that." And so I, you know, leave. I go down to the barn, look at, and I'm shoveling out the barn. And those of you who do that kind of work know just how much free time in your mind you have when you're doing that kind of work. Okay, and so I'm down there shoveling out the barn, and I started thinking, well, okay, well, if I was to start, you know, thinking of like writing a short story, what would it be about? What would I do? Look at, and so I started having an idea. Look at, and so I started working on it in my head. By the time I got back up to the house, I'd already written it. And so I just sat down in about 4 hours, and I wrote it and threw it in an envelope and mailed it off. Didn't even think about it again. It was just like, okay, it's gone. Boom. And, you know, about, I think it was like about 3 or 4 months later, we were actually visiting our daughter in Philadelphia, and Judy's cell phone rang, like, and it was Ann Hillerman is who it was. And she was asking, she said, "Craig, is there any way that you could try, and is there any way that you could be in Santa Fe on this particular date?" And she gave me the date, and I was like, no, not really. And she said, "Well, we'd really like you to come to Santa Fe on this particular date." And I said, well, you know, I was trying to think, you know, why in the world like that, you know, and then it dawned on me that it had to be that short story contest. And I said, "Does this mean I won the short story contest?" And she goes, "We'd really like you to come to Santa Fe on this date." Like, and so I did. And you know, it was really kind of great because I actually got to have dinner with Tony Hillerman. And I think I learned more in about 4 hours than I did in 4 years of college with Tony. Like, but anyway, I had this story, the short story called Old Indian Trick. And so I had the thing like that, and you know, it got to be around Christmas the next year. And I started thinking about it, and I thought, I've got all these, you know, people that are on the Post-it list. If you don't know what the Post-it list is, on my website, there's a newsletter that I send out once a month. You get 12 emails a year from me. That's all you get. Look at, and so I don't overload your inbox, I can guarantee it. So anyway, I get, you know, this, you know, there's a group of people that, you know, all sign up for the Post-it list, and I just send them, you know, little stories like that, and, you know, schedules about what it is I'm doing, where I'm going to be, and all of this. And so, you know, I had all that, and I thought, you know what, maybe it would be nice to give everybody that Christmas story. What the heck, you know, I mean, it's you know, it's not really a Christmas story like that, but I thought, give it away on Christmas like it. And so I did. At 11:59 Mountain Time, I fired it off to everybody like it. And I didn't really know what kind of problem I was making for myself until the next Christmas, when everybody started writing me and saying, "Okay, when do we get the free Christmas story this year?" And I was like, crap, I haven't written one, you know? And so I sat down real quick and I wrote another one like that. And so it's kind of been tradition over the years. Every Christmas I would sit down and I would write a short story and send it out to everybody on the list. And so Viking Penguin, you know, decided that maybe it was about time after 10 years to do a little bit of a retrospective like that and do a collection of all of the short stories. Plus, they also included the two e-specials, Divorce Horse and Messenger, like that, which up until this point, you know, have not been available in print, which made a lot of people angry, like it. And so I don't like making people angry, like it. So anyway, they did all of those, like it. And then they asked me to write another one. And I was fortunate enough, a good buddy of mine up in Sheridan told me this story, and it was pretty damn funny, one of the funniest stories I ever heard. And I thought, I'm going to have to rewrite that to make it a short story, but I think I can make it work, like it. And I did. And that's the new short story that's in here that has never appeared anywhere. And that one is called Petunia, Bandit Queen of the Bighorns. It's a sheep story. Make of that what you will. And so anyway, it's out. It's out as for about a week now, like that. And we're number 14, like that, which is, you know, kind of nice. But thank you guys, like that, for making that happen, like that. And this is kind of a special night for me too, like that, because you know, every book is dedicated. You know, every book that, you know, you write is dedicated to somebody. And one of the nice things is that every once in a while you come upon the right book for the right dedication for the right person at the right time. And I got to tell you, you that whenever I first started my writing career, one of the first big things they sent me to was the Mountains and Plains Booksellers Association meet here in Denver. And I, you know, came down here to do that. And here I was, like this cowboy from a town of 25, you know, and I had these arcs for, you know, The Cold Dish, the first Walt Longmire novel. And they sat me on a stool in this great big, you know, building. And I'm trying to hand it out, you know, to all of these booksellers, you know, and they're like, you know, that's okay, thanks, really, you know. And so, but they would ask me, they would say, you know, well, what's the book about? And you know, I guess it's starting out. And I was like, well, it's about a sheriff and there's a murder and he, you know, gets involved with it. And suddenly there would be a hand on my shoulder. And the hand on my shoulder belonged to a fellow by the name of Eric Boss, who is a sales rep for Penguin. And I guess he's like the ace sales rep, you know, of all time. He's won all of these awards like that. And he's just a pretty magnificent individual. Like that. But he would put his hand on my shoulder and lean past me and look at the booksellers and say, it's a literary mystery. It's more character driven. You know, it concerns a sheriff. And he would talk about this stuff. And finally, after by the time we got through doing this convention, people would ask me, they'd say, what's the book about? And I say, it's a literary piece. It's, you know, based on a sheriff, and go through all of this stuff. But anyway, the dedication for this particular book is for Eric Boss, Westerner, gentleman, and book rep of the First Order. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Eric Boss in the back of the house back here, who is very much responsible for my career, I can say. And then there are the acknowledgments, and then there's the introduction to this particular book, which is written by a guy who's, you know, really, he's never written anything before like that, but I thought I'd give him a leg up, you know, because he'd never done anything like this before like that. So I'm trying to help the young guy out with his career, a fellow by the name of Lou Diamond Phillips. Okay, and he wrote an absolutely magnificent introduction for the book. Like, and I don't know if you guys know all the stories about Lou, but Lou's been up, you know, in our territory twice already. And I'll tell you two quick stories. The first one, when the first time that he came up, he met with my good buddy Marcus Red Thunder, who was kind of the model for Henry. And he flew up to Billings like that. And Marcus was there, and you know, they came over and they got the bags out of the, you know, the cycle, you know, thing, you know, the luggage, you know, turntable there. Like, and you know, the guy helps, you know, give Lou Diamond Phillips' bag to Marcus. Marcus takes it and he says, "Thanks, Doug. We really appreciate it." Like, and they go out. Like, they get in the truck. They're driving out of the parking lot, and they're paying for the parking. And Marcus looks at the ticket guy and says, "Thanks, Steve. We really appreciate it." And Lou Diamond Phillips is thinking, "What the heck is, you know, he must fly in and out of the airport a lot. You know, he must know all these guys." Like, and so anyway, they go down over the hill, and they're going to do like these gifting ceremonies and sweat lodge ceremonies and tribal elders ceremonies and all these. And so they stop in a store to pick up some things, and there's a young woman standing in the aisle helping them. Like, and she helps him, tells him where to go to get all this stuff. And Marcus looks at her and says, "Thanks, Shirley. We really appreciate it." And finally, it's more than Lou Diamond Phillips can stand. He looks at my buddy Marcus and he goes, "What the hell?" He says, "Are you on the first name basis with everybody in Billings, Montana?" And Marcus looks at him and goes, "Yeah, everybody's got a name tag. Yeah." It's a very Cheyenne sense of humor. Like, and then the other story, I don't know if you guys know or not, like that, but I actually got the opportunity to write the commencement speech for the Lame Deer High School, the Northern Cheyenne High School, this year, like that. And it's a really wonderful honor, like that, because they generally don't ask somebody outside of the tribe to do it. And so I was tickled to death to do it and really poured my heart into this speech, you know, about the Northern Cheyenne and the opportunities that are afforded, you know, these young people and all of this, you know. And I wrote this speech, like that, and I finished it up. And then they told me when the date was that I was supposed to deliver the speech, like that. And it was when I was on book tour. And I said, "You know what? I'm really sorry, like that, but, you know, they set these things up like a year in advance, and there's nothing I can do. You know, I have to go do the book tour." Well, you know, they were disappointed. I was disappointed. It was just a disappointing situation all the way around. So then I was down in Santa Fe, like at, and on the set for Longmire. And, you know, and Lou walks up, like that. And Lou always asks the same question whenever he walks up. It's always the same question. He walks up and he goes, "What's going on the res?" And I said, "Well, you know, I wrote this commencement speech for the Northern Cheyenne High School, but I'm not going to be able to deliver it." And he says, "When is it?" And I told him. 3 weeks later, he flew up to Billings, Montana, jumped in a rental car, drove down to Lame Deer, and delivered the speech. It was the largest attendance they've ever had for a high school commencement on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, you know? which I thought was very nice. But anyway, what I'm going to do tonight, actually something a little bit different, something I don't normally do like that, which is I'm actually going to read something tonight like that. I normally don't do that like that, but with a short story, I figured it was probably okay because it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's only about 10 minutes long. Because I'm always thinking about that Garrison Keillor quote where he says, you know, one time I went to a book reading and something really horrible happened. An author got up and read from his book. I always try and keep that in mind like at whenever I'm doing this type of thing. So bear with me like that. And I'm still stumbling over it a little bit, but hopefully it won't be too bad. So this is actually the very first short story that I ever wrote. This is Old Indian Trick, the one that won the Tony Hillerman Award. And I hope you enjoy it. It's hard to argue with an old Indian or his tricks. I was driving Lonnie Littlebird up to Billings for an evening diabetes checkup at Deaconess Hospital when we pulled into the Blue Cow Cafe on the Crow Reservation just off I-90 for some supper. The Blue Cow had been a restaurant longer than it had been a casino. It's Montana breakfast! Exclamation point. Served all day! Exclamation point. As featured in Reader's Digest! Exclamation point. It consisted of a half a pound of bacon, 4 jumbo eggs, 12 pancakes, 3 quarters of a pound of hash browns, a pint of orange juice, and endless coffee, a Western epic well known across the High Plains. It really does exist, too, just so you know. We'd gotten a late start, and the sun was already sinking over the rolling hills of the Little Bighorn Country, was casting surrealistic shadows against the one-ton hay bales of the Indian ranchers. It was September, and with the sporadic rain of a cool August, it looked like everybody was going to get a third cutting. We rolled the windows half down and made Dog stay in the truck, and I lifted Lonnie, placing the legless man in the wheelchair, and rolled him in. He smiled at the remains of the day and picked up a free Shoshone Shopper newspaper as we passed through the double glass doors and into the restaurant. I wheeled the old Cheyenne Indian to a booth by the window where I could keep an eye on him and on the truck and on Dog, and where we could hear Montana Slim singing Roundup in the Fall through his nose on the radio in the kitchen. 1948 8N tractor, only $1,200. He held his gray and black hair back with a suntanned, wrinkled hand. Comes with a Dearborn front-end loader. I tipped my hat back, pulled a menu from the napkin holder, and looked at the tiny rainbows at the corners of his thick glasses. I don't need a tractor, Lonnie. It is a good price. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is so. I nodded and tossed the menu on the table and glanced around. You think there's anybody here? He blinked and looked over my shoulder towards the cash register, and my gaze followed his to where two sets of eyes stared at us just above the surface of the worn-out, wood-grained Formica counter. So you weren't here when it happened. The Bighorn County deputy continued to take my statement. He was young, and I didn't know him. Nope, we just stopped in for a little dinner and then noticed that everybody in the place was hiding. And you were headed to Billings? I wonder what that had to do with anything. Yep, and the old Indian was with you. I'd listened as he'd questioned Lonnie Littlebird, and I hadn't liked his tone. Lonnie. He stopped scribbling. Excuse me? I looked at my friend now parked at the corner booth and still studying the shopper. His name is Lonnie Littlebird. He's an elder and a member of the Northern Cheyenne Tribal Council. The deputy gave me a long, tough guy stare, or as much of one as he'd been able to cultivate in the 6 weeks that he'd spent at the Montana Law Enforcement Academy up in Helena. He stabbed the still shiny black notepad with his pen for emphasis. I've got that in my notes. Good. He gave me more of the look, so I smiled at him. Then it won't be hard for you to remember his name. You didn't see anybody when you pulled in? Nope. No Indian male, approximately 25 years of age. She didn't say Indian. She said dark hair with dark eyes. He didn't like being interrupted, and he liked being corrected even less. Look. Mr. I made him look for my note in the notebook for my name. A tall, heavyset man entered the cafe. He wore a large silver belly hat, a .357 revolver, and a star. He waved at the two behind the counter as I turned back to the deputy. Wanda's crow, if she thought that he was Indian, she would have said so. I caught the eye of the woman with the hairnet. Wanda, was the kid Indian? After a brief conversation with the manager, they both shook their heads no. You need to quit jerking us around and get a more detailed description of the suspect and put a unit out to circle the vicinity. Is that what you do? He studied the notebook again for my name. Evidently, he was not a quick learner. I watched as the large man with the star stood behind his deputy. Wesley Burrell Best Bales, the sheriff of Bighorn County, was a legend. Hell, I'd seen him eat the Montana breakfast. exclamation point. Served all day, exclamation point. As featured in Reader's Digest, exclamation point. Son, don't you know recognize the highly decorated peace officer of Absaroka County, Wyoming? After telling the deputy to get in his unit and ride surveillance, Wes excused him and drank a cup of coffee while I talked to the manager, Ray Bartlett. He said that a guy had come in and asked for a job, so he'd given him an application. The kid had sat in the corner until a couple of rodeo cowboys had finished up the buffet and then departed. And then he'd worked up his nerve, came up to the register, and pulled a .22 pistol from his waistband, stuck it in Wanda Pretty on Top's face, and demanded the cash. Wanda, figuring the $214 wasn't worth her life and unsure if the .22 would kill her or just hurt real bad, handed it over. He asked for the change, and she'd sighed and then dutifully dumped the coins into a deposit bag. The kid made them get down on the floor, which Wanda said was fine with her because she was dying to get off of her feet anyway. And then he told them that if they moved in the next 10 minutes, he'd shoot them. It had been about 5 when we came in. Wes filled himself another and motioned towards me, but I declined. Ray, what did the kid look like? Tall, thin, stringy long hair and a straw cowboy hat. Ray thought. Jeans, T-shirt, one of those snap front Western shirts. I nodded. Had the tail of the shirt out to cover the gun? Yep. Anything else? Ray thought about it some more. He smelled bad, and he had bad teeth. I looked at Wes and watched as he plucked the mic from his shoulder and called in the description to the deputies and the assorted HPs he had out on the prowl. We shook hands. Thanks, Walt. You bet. I walked to the booth and knocked on the table to get Lonnie's attention. You ready to go? He looked up at me. He was enthusiastic, but kept reading. They switched the electrical system over to 12 volts. He looked up. I don't know why people do that with the 8N tractor. The 6-volt system is a good one. Yes, it is so. I loaded Lonnie, folded up his wheelchair, and let the dog out and watched as the beast relieved himself and memorized every smell between the lamppost and the truck, and then let him in the back and fastened my seatbelt. Lonnie was still reading the Shoshone Shopper, and I was beginning to get worried. Are you all right? He didn't look up but continued reading. Yes. I waited a minute. I apologize for that. He still didn't look at me. For what? That deputy in there. He finally turned his head. Why should you apologize for him? I stared through the windshield and started to back out. Where are we going, Walter? I thought Lonnie must have been getting forgetful. Well, we were going to your doctor's appointment up at Deaconess, but it's getting a little late, so we're going to have to go home and reschedule. He looked back at the paper. Oh, I thought you might want to go get that young man that robbed the cafe. It was a run-down trailer park on the outskirts of Hardin, the kind that attracted tornadoes and discarded tires. We cruised the loop and stopped just short of a sun-weathered single wide with a rusted-out Datsun pickup parked in the grassless yard. A television cast its flickering blue lights across the curtained windows, and Wesley Bales, Ray Bartlett, and I turned to look at Lonnie, who folded his paper and glanced at the number on the dented mailbox alongside the dirt driveway. This is it, 644 Roundup Lane, Travis Mowry. Yes, it is so. I shrugged, placed my hat on the dash, and reached my arm behind the seat. Can I borrow your gun? Wes handed me a sidearm, and I quietly closed the door behind me and got out of the truck. I stuffed the big Colt in the back of my jeans as Wes got out on the passenger side with an 870 Remington that he'd brought from his vehicle. I glanced over to make sure that the interior lights of the truck were out. It was fully dark now, and the trailer park gave me the advantage by not having any street lights. I pulled out my wallet, rolled all the cash I had into a substantial wad, and then mounted the rickety aluminum stairs to knock on the screen door. I could make out the kitchenette and the carpet strip that led to what I assumed was the living room. Some reality show, probably A&E, was playing on the television. And I had to knock again. After a moment, a weedy-looking young woman came to the door and looked at me. She did not open the screen, and she had the look of somebody who'd taken on life early, made some bad choices, and gotten her ass kicked. I grinned, and making sure that she could see the 20 on the top of the roll, gestured with the bills. Is Travis around? She looked uncertain. I've got this money that John told me to give to him. I know it's late, but I thought he might need it. It was a calculated risk, but I figured everybody knew somebody by the name of John. She still didn't come close to the screen, and her voice was thin and halting. You can give it to me. Always let them see the money. I shook my head, but continued to smile. I'm sorry, ma'am, but I don't know you. Is Travis here? She didn't say anything but turned and disappeared. I took a deep breath and glanced back at the truck and wondered if there was any trouble, what West thought he was going to be able to do about it from all the way out there. I heard footsteps and watched as a tall, lanky young man stopped in the hallway. He wore dirty jeans, boots, and a grimy wife-beater T-shirt. He was holding a can of Coors Light and smoking a cigarette. "Who are you?" "I'm a friend of John's. I was supposed to bring this money over to you." "John who?" It would appear that not everyone knew someone named John after all. I took another calculated risk. They were working so well. "John from the bar? I mean, you're Travis Mowry, right?" I held up the cash. "Something about some money for you?" Always let them see the money. He stepped forward, pushed open the screen door, and reached for the roll of bills, and I let him have it, but then grabbed his wrist and slipping the .357 from the back of my jeans and lodged it under his jaw, yanking him from the trailer in one heave. I turned the two of us back towards the truck. The doors were open, Wes was running across the yard with a shotgun, and the manager was shaking his head. Yes. 10 minutes later, we were booking Travis Mowry at the Bighorn County Jail under the watchful eye of two highway patrolmen and three deputies, including the one that had questioned us at the Blue Cow. It appeared that the majority of eastern Montana law enforcement wanted to know how, after we'd stumbled onto a relatively cold 1052, we'd apprehended a suspect in less than 20 minutes. Travis had a four-page rap sheet, starting with his stealing a car at the age of 14. He got out and was remanded to juvenile detention. He got out again, stole another car, got caught, was sent to a foster home, ran away, and stole yet another until he graduated to producing methamphetamines in a bathtub. He'd done a two-spot in Deer Lodge where the prison psychologist had intimated that it was all a question of comparison, but that if you sat a bag of groceries next to Travis, the groceries would get into Stanford before he would. The police officer stood a little ways away from Lonnie, but snuck glances at him as he continued to read the Shoshone Shopper in Bighorn County's basement jail. As I finished up my written statement, Wes tugged at my sleeve. "All right, how did you know?" I looked at the old Indian who folded his paper in his lap and waited, along with the legendary Wesley Burrell Best Bales and the Collective Force, for my reply. "Why, Wes, that was just top-flight investigative work." I looked back at the group and tipped my hat, especially to the narrow-minded deputy. "You fellas have a good night." I waited. We were racing 150-car Burlington Northern Santa Fe down the Little Bighorn Valley, another famed site of monumental hubris and stupidity. There was a slight breeze rustling the sage and the buffalo grass, and obelisks and the markers of the 7th Cavalry almost discernible in the light of the just-risen moon. Lonnie remained quiet, his veined arm resting on the door sill, his thick-lensed glasses reflecting the stripe of the Milky Way, stretching from horizon to horizon, what the Indians call the Hanging Road. "Did I ever tell you about that rattlesnake I ran over with my father's 8N tractor?" I sighed and wondered what sort of pithy homespun philosophy this story would turn out to illustrate. "When I got back from Korea, he had two hayfields, and one was about 3 miles down the county road. It was a Friday afternoon, and I had just finished cutting. I was a young man and in a hurry. But I saw this big rattler sunning himself on the road. Not the smartest thing to do," he chuckled. "He was a big one. He had about 12 buttons on that tail, and..." "All right, Lonnie, how did you know it was Travis Mowry?" He turned to look at me, hurt at my interrupting his story. "And how the heck did you know that he lived at 644 Roundup Lane?" He half-smiled, and his eyes returned to the stars as he nodded with the words, "OIT. I thought about the well-known phrase in our part of the world. Old Indian trick?" He continued nodding and carefully pulled Travis Mowry's Blue Cow Cafe employment application sheet from the folds of the newspaper. He handed it to me, and the form was completely filled out. "Mm-hmm, yes, it is so." I get into a lot of trouble like that because, you know, one of my favorite quotes is from Wallace Stegner, where he says that, you know, the greatest piece of fiction ever written is that disclaimer that's at the beginning of every book that says nobody in this book is based off of anybody alive or dead, you know. And the problem with that, of course, is that I live in a state that only has 500,000 people in it, you know. And so if I use somebody from up in Gillette in my book, somebody from down in Rock Springs will go, "Is that so-and-so? It's in your third book, you know." I have to say that I can neither confirm nor deny that maybe the person that you just mentioned. Look at, but then it gets even worse when I go up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, because there are only 5,000 enrolled members in the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. And the model, actually, for Lonnie Little Bird is a fellow by the name of Charles Little Old Man. And I'm proud to say that Charles Little Old Man is now one of the chiefs of the Northern Cheyenne tribe. Look at, and how he got the job was he fell asleep during one of the meetings. Which evidently is the rite of secession for a lot of Northern Cheyenne chiefs. Like you fall asleep during a meeting, you can't defend yourself. Like and everybody elects you unanimously, you end up having the job. Okay, but anyway, at this point in time, what I'd like to do is open it up and let you guys ask some questions. I always try and leave a little bit of extra time, you know, for questions because it takes me a long time to answer. As a matter of fact, it takes me about 20 minutes to answer each question. So I think we have time for one question. And no, I'm just kidding. I'll stay here as long as she lets me. That's what, you know, she's kind of tough. She's got that roll of duct tape she'll use on me if I don't. You can ask me about anything. You can ask me about the books, the short stories, the TV show, anything you'd like to ask me about, I'm more than happy to talk about. Yes, ma'am.
So if you can't have any more bonfire on TV, can we do a movie?
Well, you know, the story right now is that, I don't know how many of you know the story like that, but in their infinite wisdom, A&E decided to cancel the highest-rated scripted drama the network has ever had, a show that was averaging close to 6 million viewers a week, one of the top 25 shows, both cable and network, for the summer, a show that is showing in almost 150 countries around the world right now. And my favorite thing about it is when they canceled it, they tried to put a spin on it and say the reason that they were canceling it was because it wasn't pulling in the younger demographic. And let me tell you how to piss off people. And let me tell you another group you really don't want to piss off, okay? Because all of us over 49, you know, we've been to the rodeo, we got our buckle, and we don't give a shit, you know? So it's been kind of horrifying to see the response, like, you know, and there's this group, you know, that's the Longmire Posse, like at on this social network, like at on Facebook and on Twitter, and let me tell you, they are ruthless. They are a ruthless bunch, like at, and actually, it's been kind of fun to watch because ever since A&E made that statement, their ratings on their network have dropped every single week, and I don't want to wish anybody ill will like that, but, you know, my gosh, you just can't cure stupid, you know? I mean, you know? And so we'll wait to see what happens. But what happened was basically was is that A&E wanted to own the show. They wanted to own it, like, because the show was actually produced by Warner Brothers, Warner Horizon, the TV segment of Warner. And so they produced the show. And then what they do is they charge a licensing fee to the networks, you know, to be able to show it. And A&E didn't want to, you know, pay that licensing fee anymore. They wanted to own the show. Well, the last show that they came up with lasted for 2 weeks, and then it was gone, you know. And so, you know, Warner was like, well, no, we've got a hit show. Why would we want to sell it to you? You know, we're gonna go ahead and keep it ourselves. Like, and A&E's response was, well, we'll just cancel the show then. And Warner's response to that was, go ahead, we'll find another network. I mean, this is the studio that taught James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart how to be tough guys, right? So I'm like, good luck with that, you know. And so anyway, what they're in the process now of doing is they're repitching it to a number of different services and a number of different networks. And it takes a certain amount of time to go through all of those because they have to go through all of them, you know, before they try and make a decision on this. And I'm hearing different rumors every day. You know, I mean, I've heard the USA Channel. I've heard TNT. I've heard NBC. I've heard Netflix. I've heard Amazon. I've heard all these different, you know, groups like it. And so I'm not reporting on any of it until they finally settle on something like it. And so, you know, I'm just going to keep my mouth shut about that kind of stuff until it's finally all the dust is settled like it, and we'll see what happens. So, yeah. 20 minutes, I told you.
How much input do you have on what they write for those shows?
Well, you know, you're looking at an executive creative consultant is what you're looking at here. He was asking how much control I have over, you know, the show. And it's really kind of funny like that because Hollywood is kind of notorious for kind of kicking the author, you know, to the side and going on down the road. And I've been really, really fortunate because it's a really good group of people who were interested in really kind of capturing the tone and the feel and the texture of the books. I mean, they're limited because, you know, they have a 42-minute format in which to work, you know, and my books are like 350, 400 pages long, you know. And so if they were easily encapsulated into 42 minutes, and I should be writing 42-page books, and you guys wouldn't want to read that. And so anyway, it's been kind of interesting. But, yeah, they've had me involved pretty much from the get-go, starting with, you know, whenever they did the casting for the show. And, you know, they actually sent me the DVDs. That was where my wife actually made the remark to me that, you know, she really liked Robert Taylor because he was kind of like a TV version of me, taller, better looking, with a better voice. And you're going to see a lot of that Matthew McConaughey impersonation as we drive back up I-25. Okay, so. And anyway, like at, you know, it, but it's they, which actually what they do, they've got a room full of writers, and they all down there, you know, get together and they write these, you know, these episodes kind of in mass, like if they do it as a group. And then what they do is they send me, you know, the screenplay, like, and then I go through like that and give them a line edit. And it's about 50-50. Some of the stuff they do because, you know, I know what I'm talking about. Some stuff they do because it's for TV, like, and they know a lot more about television production than I do. But, you know, I do know a little bit more about Wyoming. There was one, I think the opening episode, they had Walt was going to drive down to Wheatland and be back in an hour. And I was like, I don't think so. You know, all I could think was, man, the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department just bought a Learjet, I guess. Okay, you know, so. Yes. Oh, there are tons of them. There are so many. I mean, the quote that I actually used in this particular book, In Wait for Signs, is a Louis L'Amour quote. It's the one where he says, many men I met that day bragged of the miles they'd traveled, but very few of the things they'd actually seen. That's good writing, you know? And anybody who thinks Louis L'Amour can't write, read Hondo. And that'll change your mind like that. But you know what? All those classic, you know, era Western writers, you know, I'm really, you know, big on the Walter Van Tilburg Clarks, you know, who did the Oxbow Incident, Track of the Cat, all of those like that. Jack Schaefer, you know, Shane, Monty Walsh, like that. One of my favorites, Dorothy Johnson, little school marm from up in Missoula, Montana, who wrote The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, Man Called Horse, Hanging Tree. And one of my absolute favorites, Lost Sister. There's a little, you know, a little, I guess, an extended short story that she wrote that I don't understand why anybody hasn't made that into a movie. But it's about these four sisters coming across the West in a Conestoga wagon. They get attacked, and one of the sisters is taken. And I think it's like 17 years later they bring the sister back and try and reintegrate her into the family. And it's a marvelous, marvelous piece like that. But there was that classic era, you know, of Western writing like that, that just, you know, it just knocks you dead, you know. And it's kind of a shame because a lot of those pieces have kind of been dropped, you know, from the curriculum of a lot of, you know, literature classes because they're in that Western ghetto. You know, and Western literature kind of, you know, seems to be seen more as a genre literature, you know, rather than being seen for what it is, which is just, you know, damn fine literature, especially in the hands of those individuals, I have to say. So another one that doesn't get credit for being a Western writer is John Steinbeck, you know, and I mean, there's a reason why it is that Henry's Bar is called the Red Pony. You know, and so, you know, that's another one of my favorites, I have to admit, too. But I could go on all night on that. So, yes. Which book was the most enjoyable one for me to write? Yee, that's a tough question. Usually whatever the newest book is. You know, I mean, generally whatever book I'm working on right now is the one I'm the most excited about, and it's the best book I've ever written. And then the worst book is the one that I just finished, you know, so... I don't know what to make of that dynamic, but there it is, you know. Like that. So I think it comes down to that, you know, don't ever get too carried away with yourself, you know. And, you know, I mean, I remember Mark Sprague and I were having a drink at the Front Street Bar up in Evan Red Lodge. You guys are going to think all I do is hang around in bars and Red Lodge. But we were actually sitting there, like, and he picked up a book and he says, you know what you don't want to have happen, Craig? And I said, no, what's that? He goes, you don't ever want to pick up one of your books and open it up and go, you know, a great man wrote that, you know, like, you know, you know, get a handle on yourself, you know. So, yes, ma'am. Oh, thank you. Oh, my gosh. You traveled further than we did. Did you come in on Santa Fe? Like, you know. Oh my. Oh, okay. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. The books are, you know, our bestsellers over in France. I mean, they're not just translated; they're actually bestsellers. And I used to have so much respect for the French, you know. And so she is. My translator is pretty wonderful, I have to admit. But my street cred, you know, actually went up, you know, way up. Like whenever I started bringing the wife to Paris twice a year, like I got to tell you, like, you know, she likes you, Cross, like, but I don't know where she buys her shoes tends to be Paris, like it. So but anyway, but thank you so much. Thank you for making all this travel all this way. Oh, thank you. One of my favorite stories is the French are crazy. They're just nuts. Like, I got to tell you, because they'll just jump in a car and go, or jump on a plane and go, like at wherever it is. Like, I had to laugh like that because my French publisher, Oliver Gaumeister, like that, he actually he said, you know, he said, well, I'm coming over to America for our big you know, American Western vacation. And I was like, wow. I said, that's amazing. Like, I said, where are you planning on going? He said, well, we're going to fly into Vancouver, and then we're going to drive over to Glacier National Park, and then we're going to swing down through Yellowstone, and then through Jackson and through that area, and then we're going to swing over into Utah and do Bryce Canyon, that area, down into Monument Valley, back up through Mesa Verde, then hit Rocky Mountain National Park, up back through, stop at your ranch in the Bighorns, and then swing back over and go back to Vancouver and, you know, and go home. And I said, well, how much time do you have? And he said, we have 2 weeks. And I was like, wow, that's impressive. Like, and so whenever he got started on the trip, like, we hadn't heard from him in about a week, and we thought, wonder how that's going, you know? Or, you know, it's kind of like National Lampoon's European Vacation. Look, kids, the Tetons. Look, kids. And so, but anyway, I hadn't heard from him for about a week. Like, and so, you know, we called him up on the phone, like, and he said, well, yeah, we haven't quite made the distance I was hoping we would. And I said, well, this was like a week into the trip. And I said, well, where are you? He said, we're in Yellowstone. And I was like, okay, all right. Like, and he says, is there any way you could come over and have dinner? And I was like, sure. You know, it's like, it's going to take us about, you know, 5 hours to get there and back. But, you know, but sure. Like, so we drove over and we got there actually before they got there at the Flag Ranch where we were going to have dinner. And we got there. And I'll never forget Oliver pulling up in the minivan that they were driving, like that, and he pulls up, like, and his eyes are like as big as ping pong balls, like it, and he gets out and he walks up to us and he's kind of staggering and he goes, this is a very big country. And I started laughing and he goes, and it's much bigger when you have three children in the back seat. Look at me, I was like, pretty much. Look at, so are you cutting me off? Is that it? Looks like that's it. I apologize. Okay, but it looks like that's it. Like, I want to thank everybody for coming out. Can I ask, what, can I let one more question go? Like, can I let them have one more? Okay, you look like you're about to die if I don't answer this question. So, oh, all of the items like that Judy has and the sheriff's department's hats and everything, those are on the Walmart, as I refer to it, on the website. Like, they're actually on our website. Like, but then. Yeah. The other opportunity is come up to Buffalo, Wyoming for Longmire Days, you know, at the end of July, beginning of August, with 12,000 of your closest friends, like, and the entire cast of Longmire, which is kind of fun, like that. So keep that in mind, if you would. Thank you guys so much. Thank you. So lovely to be here with you. So. Oh, please. All right, I need a beer.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.